Hello, John Bywaters, and thank you much for joining us here at The Last Post. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you, and thanks for the interview. This is fantastic, being able to talk to people after all this time and still keep the message going out there. It's a wonderful thing that this land of music we're involved in, isn't it?
Yes, it's a wonderful thing, John, and you've got quite a legacy being, of course, a member of Australia's... Well, I think you had the first number one Australian hit on the Go Set charts back in 66, was that right?
Yeah, there were number ones before that, like Slim Dusty with Pub and with No Beer and all that sort of stuff. But that wasn't in the Go Set top 40, I don't think.
No, that's right. You certainly did a magnificent thing. And as a member of the Twilights, you crossed many frontiers and achieved a lot in your time. How did it all start, John?
Well, I was in a four-piece group called the Hurricanes.
Mm-hmm.
And in 64, June 64, I think, the Beatles hit our shores.
Yep.
And there was a band or a vocal group from Elizabeth, which is a satellite town about 20 k's north of Adelaide. They were called the Twilights. They were a vocal group. And they started doing Beatles stuff, and we did as well in the Hurricanes, although we didn't have vocalists to support us. And there was a Beatles satellite competition at the Palais Royal just before the Beatles came in June.
Mm-hmm.
And the Twilight's vocal group, Trio, were backed by a local Elizabeth band called the Vector Men. And we hadn't met them, but they won the competition. My band, the Hurricanes, we sang a Beatles song called Little Child, and we came second.
Yes.
And then not long after that, we got a call from the vocal group saying, would we be interested in backing them? So we said yes, and we were working quite regularly, and they were working regularly, doing about three gigs a week. And we were the Hurricanes and the Twilights at that time.
I see.
And then some bright spark, maybe Glenn Shorrock or somebody, said, why don't we just amalgamate and call it all the Twilights? And that sounded like a good idea, and that's what we did. And we never looked back from that day.
Magnificent stuff. And, John, a significant year, 64, then, obviously. The Beatles and the Twilights.
Yeah, I would venture to say, if there were no Beatles, we wouldn't be having this conversation today, you know, because we would have kept doing Everly Brothers songs and Kingston Trio and what have you, and... who knows what would have happened, but the Beatles sort of changed the face of music, as you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, indeed. And I think initially, correct me if I'm wrong, John, but you covered a lot of songs, but you gave them a Twilight sound, which was so unique.
Yeah. We were very, very fortunate that we had good instrumentalists. We had, at that time, Kevin Peake on guitar, but he left and he brought his replacement, Terry Britton, along and said, here's your new guitarist, I'm leaving. So that was a step up. And we had great vocalists in Glenn Shorrock and Paddy McCartney.
That's right. Paddy was very good too. And Terry Britton was indeed, as it turned out, quite a find from Kevin Peake, obviously a great guitarist too, but Terry was significant in his joining the group, I think. Did you have the first single in 65? Was that right?
65. It was either late 64 or early 65. It was called I Don't Know Where the Wind Will Blow Me, written by Peter Brightoak, I think, and maybe Glenn had a hand in that as well.
Mm-hmm. And did that attract the attention of interstate people, or how did that go?
I think the first couple of singles didn't do much. The third single got noticed in Melbourne, I believe. I can't remember what that was called. Might have been John Hardy or... I don't know. And we then got invited to go to Melbourne. So I think the third single sort of did it.
Yeah, and then you went to Melbourne in 66, was that right, John?
The early 66, yes. And that's right, and we shifted there permanently and worked all around Australia out of Melbourne, that's right.
Was it an exciting time for you?
We didn't consider it exciting because it was just a lot of work. I was married at the time, would you believe? I got married very young, and my wife and young baby sort of followed me to Melbourne. And as a matter of fact, I'm still married to the same lady today, Valerie. It's our
isn't that lovely
anniversary next month. 55 years it'll be.
Congratulations, John. That's an achievement, and certainly in the world of music.
Thank you. Yes,
that's wonderful.
So we didn't consider it to be exciting. We just sort of thought we're doing our job. You know, we're doing it as best we can. We had no plan. And I guess if you're good enough and dedicated enough, something will come of it. And in our case, it certainly did, yes.
Was there some feeling that this would happen when you went to Melbourne? Were you expecting to become big, or was it just something that evolved?
No, no. Everything was organic with us. We had no plan. we just went with the flow. And because we're working regularly and we're all good mates and... we went down well wherever we played, and we got a lot of respect from local musicians. We just felt it was our calling, you know, and we just kept doing it. We didn't know where it was going to end up or where it was going to take us. Mm. And as I said, we just went with the flow.
Well, Glenn Shorrock told me that his time with the Twilights was his favourite time in his musical career, so it must have been something that you had.
He's often said that to me. He said, you know, the Twilights is my favourite band. And look what he's done. Like Axiom and LRB, I mean, yeah. He's kicked a few goals there, the old Glenn. We're going to see him next month here in Adelaide.
Lovely.
He's at the Gov.
Yep.
Yeah.
Are you going to that? Are you part of that? Or what's the story there?
I'm not part of that one, but we are going as guests because, funnily enough, it's going to be our wedding anniversary.
Oh, wow. Okay, wow.
And Glenn was at our wedding, actually.
Oh, wow. How good's that?
Yeah.
So things really changed, I think, John. Correct me if I'm wrong, with Needle in a Haystack. Where did you get that song from?
Our manager, Gary Spry, suggested it. It was a Tamla Motown song by the Velvets. And he heard it, and he brought it to us, and we put our spin on it, and it actually... went to number one. We're on the boat leaving for England, would you believe?
Oh, wow. So that's of course, come in a time that was very, very interesting for the Twilights. But did you know when you recorded Needle that did you feel it was going to be a hit?
No, we just liked it. We just, when Gary played it to us, we didn't sort of get the beat. It was different because... it was, as I said, a Motown song. It was very light and sort of hairy fairy. And when we heard it, we thought, well, we should make it Four on the Floor, more straight ahead, and that's what we did. But I can't remember if we ever thought it was going to be a hit. We didn't think about that with any of our songs. We considered them all to be good songs. Otherwise, we wouldn't have recorded them, you know.
Yeah, mere point taken. But 67, of course, you won the Hoadleys?
In 66.
66, and then...
September.
Yeah, okay. And then you were up against some good groups then too, John.
Absolutely. I think the group might have come second. That's the GROOP. But there was bands from all over Australia, of course.
It was a magnificent celebration of Australian music, the Hoadley's Battle of the Sounds. I used to follow it as a kid with great reverence and was rapt, you know, I don't know how old I was, 12 or something when that happened, but when you won, but it was a great achievement. And then, of course, you hopped on the ship and went to England.
Yeah, I think the Hoadley's thing might have been in about August, and I think we left the next month. We couldn't wait. I mean, in hindsight, we should have actually kept working and collected a bit of a war chest, you know, had some money behind us, and then we could have actually sat over there a bit longer, but we didn't. We were just keen to go. and off we went as quick as we could, you know.
The trip over, did you play on the ship or...?
Oh, absolutely. The Hoadley's competition was only open to bands of up to five pieces, and we were six. And we won it as a five piece, but of course when we did our encore thing, we brought Paddy back on because he was obviously the spear member. We did our encore with Paddy, although he wasn't allowed in the competition. But to pay for his ticket to go to England, we had to play on the boat. And I think we might have played three nights a week on the ship.
Okay, that's and then so what were your first impressions, John, when you got to England?
hard to put a finger on it because you can't see a scene. You can't. It's not tangible.
Mm-hmm.
You know nothing about it. And we got picked up at Southampton Harbour by a man from EMI, a fellow called Roy Squires, and we all got on the train, which we thought was cute, you know, the train back to London to the EMI offices.
Mm.
And we were just quizzing him in the train, like, what's number one and all that. And do you realise what the number one song was when we got to England?
No.
It was Good Vibrations by the Beach Boys.
Well, how lovely. I mean, yeah, what a hallmark.
Yeah, now, we were on the ship for 6 weeks. We had no idea what the hit parade was doing. So we had to ask people, you know. We were sort of incommunicado on the boat, as you could imagine. No such thing as the internet to sort of keep you up to date.
No, back in those days, it was totally different. It would have been like being stranded on an island.
Absolutely. I mean, we had little transistor radios that only picked up stations when you were close to land. And I remember having a little tranny, and I think I heard a Cat Stevens song from somewhere in Egypt, I think, as we went close to the shore. But that was the extent of it. I mean, we were incommunicado. And the only songs we heard on the boat were what was on the jukebox.
Oh,
the,
God.
The local jukebox, you know.
Yeah. Well, so in England, and then what was the plan there? Did you end up playing many gigs?
Well, the deal was you had one gig. You had a recording contract, and you had one gig. And when we got to England, we operated out of the EMI offices because we had a recording contract with EMI. So we rang the organisation that was supposed to give us the gig, and that was called the Grade Organisation. They were a booking agent.
Mm-hmm.
And we said, "We're the Twilights from Australia." And they said, "Yeah, and what?" And we said, "We've won the Hobie's Battle of the Sands." And they said, "What's that? What's Hobie's?" They said.
Oh, jeez.
They knew nothing about it, right?
Oh, God.
So our manager had to go and plead our case, and they took pity on us, and they gave us quite a few gigs, actually. We did a few local club gigs in London. We went to the Cavern Club, played there twice. We did a Saturday evening and a Sunday afternoon.
What, in Liverpool?
Yes, the original Cavern,
Wow.
Yeah, and the Beatles had no longer played there anymore. Mm. There was a sign above the door that said, "The Beatles played here 292 times, I think.
Jeez. How did it feel playing the Cavern?
Well, that's a disused wine cellar. It was pretty grimy, and the crowds were right into it. And we played the Saturday night, as I said. We were one of about five bands on the bill. And they liked us and invited us back for the next day. We did the Sunday. Yes, it was pretty good, you know. We played at the Cavern Club, and not many bands can say that, can they?
No, that's right. Indeed. That's another thing that is good to have on the CV. It's quite incredible and limited to a certain number of people, the Twilights amongst them. So
yeah.
I suppose as it evolved, I believe that you got a time at the Abbey Road Studios.
Yeah, we recorded three singles there.
Mm-hmm.
What did we do? 950,
yeah.
Young Girl, and What's Wrong With The Way I Live.
Was 950 and What's Wrong With The Way I Live, was that a double-sided single?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, because I remember buying that as a kid, and that was a super, super single. It was two really good songs, no, really good stuff. And you had some experience there, or some of the members of the groups actually saw the Beatles there, or?
The Beatles were recording in another studio across the hallway, and somebody came back and said they'd saw John Lennon.
Mm.
I think it was Glenn. I mean, that story's been sort of twisted over the years. Somebody said that they were in the toilet with John Lennon, but...
That was Jim Keyes, I think.
He said the same thing, didn't he?
Yeah, that's right. Everyone was in the toilet.
It must be a big toilet. That was the place to be, yeah.
That's right. That's where you met the Beatles. Jeez. Wow. And what was that experience like for you?
Well, that was very down to business. Our producer was Norman Smith, who had engineered with George Martin.
Mm.
You were in their hands. They knew what they were doing. And all you had to do was just perform and make sure that you knew your stuff. They made you feel very welcome, actually.
Mm.
That was a great experience. you know, having recorded there, that hallowed place, Abbey Road, it was fantastic, you know.
Yeah, look, I think that's absolutely fantastic indeed, and I know it's an achievement to be, well, to be savoured, mate. I think it's an excellent thing. You came back to Australia. You had some more good music coming out, of course, but had things changed? I mean, apparently you were surprised at the number of very good groups similar to the Twilights that weren't getting anywhere. Did you feel frustrated?
I can't remember exactly that. The scene was changing.
Mm-hmm.
It was moving more towards... I guess the flower power movement was sort of in full swing.
Mm.
And you had the likes of Billy Thorpe and the Sunbury sort of experience happening.
Mm.
The Beatles, I think from memory, were off the boil because they'd stopped touring.
Mm.
And I think they'd stopped releasing singles at that point.
Mm.
I think, and we felt that the scene was changing, and they had to do something new to sort of grab a hold of. We looked at a few Motown things, like stuff by the Four Tops, and thought that might have been what people were after, but it's a bit hard to know. And as I said, Billy Thorpe was getting into his Sunbury mode, where you'd have a 30-minute guitar solo, stuff like that. You know? And people were starting to grow their hair longer.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was starting to get less formalised and more, more virtuosity in the musical content, you know.
Freelance, wasn't it, really? It was like it was avant-garde more. It became...
That's the word, avant-garde, yeah. You could feel that happening, actually.
Mm. And when you got back to Australia, John, I know that there was an album that you had out, Once Upon a Twilight, that was supposed to be very, very good.
Yeah, that was named the same as a TV pilot we'd made, which was
TV
show.
Yes.
Was going to be called Once Upon a Twilight,
and
we did film the pilot for that.
You were going to be the Monkees of Australia.
Yes, and funny enough, the director of the film, he didn't know what we were talking about when we said the Monkees, because he was getting us to do things, and we'd say, "Oh, the Monkees did that," and he'd say, "What's the Monkees?" You know, he didn't. It was a bit sort of strange, but yes, it was. I guess in that same vein as the Monkees. Mm. Yeah,
and it didn't. They didn't go ahead with it, but it must have been an interesting experience to actually be part of that. I mean, the Seven Network obviously felt strongly enough about the group to recommend a weekly series.
Now, for some reason or other, they didn't pick it up because the show had no sponsor.
Mm.
It was going to be GMH because we were driving around Tirana's while we were filming. They supplied the cars.
Mm.
But when push come to shove and they didn't pick up the pilot, it went nowhere. Of course, they couldn't sell it to any other network because it had the kiss of death on it.
Yeah, that's right. It would have been an interesting experiment, and it's a pity that it didn't evolve further, but that's the way life goes. You... some great singles towards the end with Young Girl and Kathy Come Home. Did you feel it was getting towards the end?
Well, we certainly did after England, we were sort of just floundering around a bit, really, just trying to think what we'd do next. And we thought that the TV pilot, we thought that might have led us to somewhere, like a different career path, being TV stars as well as, you know, as well as musicians and doing concerts. But when it wasn't to be and they didn't pick up the pilot, that really knocked the wind out of our sails.
Yeah.
And I think it started to go flat from there on.
Yeah, point taken, John. I think you yourself, you've had some magnificent achievements over your period of time, obviously with, you're the first, correct me if I'm wrong again, the first inductee into the South Australian Music Hall of Fame?
Yeah, how'd you know about that?
Oh, mate,
Eyes everywhere, I know.
that's, be careful of what you say. But that's right.
Yeah.
That's
absolutely true, yes.
And an achievement, too. Do you remember that night?
I do, but I remember the phone call that I got from the late David Day.
Yes, David Day was good, yeah.
he rang me up and he said, "Do you mind if we induct you into the Hall of Fame?"
Mm.
And there was no Hall of Fame at that point.
Mm.
And I said, "What do you mean?" And he wouldn't elaborate further. He just said, "We'd like to induct you for your contribution to Australian music."
Wow.
And more particularly South Australia.
Yeah.
Because at the South Australian Hall of Fame, of course, you know. And he wouldn't tell me who nominated me or anything, you know. So,
do you think it was Daisy that nominated you?
I don't know. I'm on that committee now, and I still can't find out.
Jeez. Well, look at the greats that have followed you too, Beeb and Barry and Barry Smith and a whole lot of other. Yeah, so you led the way, and what an achievement to be the first inductee. What are you doing now, John?
Well, I'm still working full-time in a business with my daughter, Colleen.
Mm-hmm.
I believe you know my other sister, Ricky. She might have filled you in on a few details.
Yes.
But anyway, Colleen is my daughter. She's the young girl that came to Melbourne with us when she was 6 months old, would you believe?
Oh, wow.
And now we're working together in a company called Badger Minute. And we do badges and engraving and sandblasting of wine glasses and disc signs and plates and little things like that. And that business has been around for yonks since the early 80s. And
what's the name of it? Give it a plug, John. What's the name?
Badge Art Minute. BADGEAMINIT.
Okay.
And we make button badges and we sell badge machines. Who would have thought that badges had a future, but they certainly have.
Yeah, that's right. Incredible stuff. You've been a wonderful adornment and contributor to the Australian music and arts scene through your involvement not only with the Twilights but by yourself, John, and we congratulate you on your career, and we know that it's still continuing, so we know that there may be more things for you in the future. It's absolutely great to speak with you.
Well, I'm playing with lots of local bands at the moment, Greg. You can't put a good man down, obviously. And I'm still doing it at age 75, would you believe?
Oh, come on, so young.
I know. I'm playing in about five different bands, and I'm in a community band with my wife. We do free shows at libraries and pageants and kindergartens and nursing homes. So You've got to give back a little bit, don't you?
Well, I think I'd want to register at the nursing home if they had a former member of the Twilights playing. That's enough. That's incredible.
Oh, you're too kind.
No, John Bywaters, first inductee into the South Australian Music Hall of Fame, famous formerly as a bassist for the Twilights and now continuing his musical career in South Australia and elsewhere. We thank you very much for your time today, John.
My absolute pleasure, Greg, and I wish you all the best. Thank you.
Thank you.